राधवा कुंज विहारी राधवा कुंज विहारी जय राधा माधवा कुंज विहारी गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवराधारी बीजन गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवराधारी बीजन शोदनंदन व्रज जन रंजन शोदनंदन व्रज जन रंजन यमुना तीरा वनचारी तीरा वनचारी तेरा जय राधा माधव कुंज विहारी राधा माधव जय राधा माधवा कुंज विहारी गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवराधारी गोपी जन वल्लभा गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवराधारी गोपी जन वल्लभा शौरनंदन व्रज जन रंजन शौरनंदन शौरनंदन व्रज जन रंजन शौरनंदन रावण चारी रावण चारी रावण तीरा वन चारी तीरा जय राधा माधवा कुंज विहारी जय राधा माधवा कुंज विहारी जय राधा माधवा कुंज विहारी जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस गरीबराज काचार्य स्तोत्र सतसी श्रीमरी श्री भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी प्रभुपाद की जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस गरीबराज काचार्य स्तोत्र सतसी श्रीमद भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती ठाकुर की जय जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस गरीबराज काचार्य स्तोत्र सतसी श्रीमद भक्ति विनोद ठाकुर की जाय श्री भक्ति विनोद ठाकुर की जाय श्री भक्ति विनोद ठाकुर की जाय आनंद कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जाय नामाचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की जाय प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद से दैत गदाधर श्रीवास आदि गौर भक्तवृंद की जाय श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गौ गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंद राधा कुंद गिरी गोवर्धन की जाय वृंदावन धाम की जाय मायापुर धाम की जाय जगन्नाथ स्वामी की जाय गंगा मई की जाय जमुना मई की जाय तुलसी देवी की जाय भक्ति देवी की जाय समवेत भक्तवृंद की जाय All glories to the assembled devotees. Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari. So, Hare Krishna. Today is the blessed appearance day of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So, and if we look historically, we see that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is really the beginning of the modern Hare Krishna movement. As we know, the world changed dramatically in the last several hundred years. Europe was in the Dark Ages, and well, still is, but not exactly the same way. I mean, there was a time when basically anywhere in Europe or anywhere in the Middle East or any of these countries, practically anywhere outside India, trying to preach Krishna consciousness would have been punishable by death. And the world was filled with ignorance and superstition, and there was a renaissance triggered, actually, by the coming of Lord Chaitanya. It's interesting to note that when Columbus, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, trying to get to Gaudadesh, actually, when Lord Chaitanya was there. Because in 1492, Lord Chaitanya was 6 years old. Columbus was trying to go to the eastern coast of India, which is where Lord Chaitanya was. So sometimes in history, people don't know why they're drawn to certain places, they're drawn to certain events. But actually, I mean, I will get to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but I just want to set the scene that the world dramatically changed, and the fact that Columbus was trying to find Lord Chaitanya, he didn't exactly know what he was doing, but actually trying to get to Gaudadesh when Lord Chaitanya was 6 years old there. And with the discovery of other worlds, the world dramatically changed. Europe came out of its isolation. There was a dramatic globalization, which really changed the world, even back then, hundreds of years ago, and led to this great acceleration of culture and opening called the Renaissance, the rebirth. What they thought it was, the Renaissance, or Renaissance, or the rebirth, was the rebirth of classical culture, Roman and Greek culture, philosophy and learning and open-mindedness and so on. That's why they called it the rebirth. But really, it's a rebirth of Vedic culture. Because if you take that spirit of the Renaissance, a return to open-mindedness, to the free inquiry into truth, which is the beginning of Vedanta, Tato Brahma Jigyasa. Now, let us try to understand the highest truth. And so, the world changed in so many ways, and Europe eventually became present in India. Really from the 17th century, England and Denmark, actually, and Portugal and Germany, other many countries actually came and had colonies in India. And the world continued to change, and it was actually Bhaktivinoda Thakur, this is the point I'm getting at, it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur that really clearly understood and explicitly understood. It wasn't just a vague intuition he had. He talked about it in very explicit terms. The world has changed. It's not the world that people used to know. And it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur that really clearly understood the need for a modern Hare Krishna movement, which was absolutely faithful to the essential principles of Krishna consciousness, as taught by Krishna himself and as taught by Krishna as Lord Chaitanya, and yet a movement which was really in the modern world, and took advantage of modern facilities, communicated in modern ways, spoke a language which was understandable to people who were very different than people used to be, who had different assumptions and different ways of understanding things. So this Bhaktivinoda Thakur really is the father of the modern Hare Krishna movement. I think that's a clear historical fact. And it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur, of course, who prayed for a ray of Vishnu, was granted him in the form of his son, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who took this inspiration of Bhaktivinoda Thakur to make the Hare Krishna movement, Lord Chaitanya's movement, relevant and appealing in this new world. And of course, Bhaktisiddhanta took giant steps forward. So, really carrying out the spirit of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I think, is something which can't be overemphasized, the extent to which Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, with all of his revolutionary, shocking innovations, and they were shocking at the time, was really faithfully serving his father and very much carrying out the inspiration of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So there was, it's hard nowadays because the world is so liberal and open nowadays that it's, you have to sort of put yourself in a different state of mind to understand what it was like at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his son Bhaktisiddhanta, and of course Prabhupada, who completely globalized this vision. It was Prabhupada who took Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and Prabhupada was very acutely aware of his own vital connection to Bhaktivinoda Thakur through his guru, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and of course the Parampara. Prabhupada was very much felt and understood that he was carrying out this original vision, inspiration of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and globalizing it, really fulfilling the dream of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, including the vision that people, Vaishnavas all around the world, would chant and dance the name of Lord Chaitanya and Mayapur and so on. So, I mean, just to give an example, Bhaktivinoda Thakur taught and wrote and sang in English. And there was an orthodox Hindu culture, which is really beginning to vanish now, because, I mean, everyone that, I haven't been to India in several years, but everyone that comes back from India says the same thing. Boy, it's really changed. And so India very much has become globalized, at least the cities. And so the India that existed during the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, was born in the 1830s, really is vanishing to some extent. And it was an Indian which many people felt it was actually inappropriate to even preach in English, because English was a profane language, it was a mundane language, that the appropriate medium for preaching was Sanskrit. That one should write, and there were Brahmins that, or Indian languages. And so the fact that he taught in English, and the fact that he was educated, Bhaktivinoda Thakur very much reminds us of the Goswamis, in the sense that the Goswamis were highly educated people. They were government ministers. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a highly placed government official, and he was highly educated. Just like, for example, the six Goswamis, their native language was, I mean, their language of birth was Bengali. They were from West Bengal, Gododesh. Not all of them, actually. I take that back, but Rupa and Sanatan. And some, was it Raghunath? Who was from South India? Gopal Bhatta. But of course, they were fluent in Sanskrit and fluent in Persian. They were fluent in the language of the occupiers. Or they were fluent in the language of these Mletcha rulers. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur was also fluent in the language of the Mletcha rulers. And because he was a government official, just like them. So there are these resemblances in terms of how Lord Chaitanya situates his pure devotees for their mission. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur was, let me put it this way, it was not at all clear to most people in India that it was appropriate to even preach to non-Hindus. Now, Lord Chaitanya did. Lord Chaitanya, of course, converted Haridas Thakur. And there are other incidents with some Pattan soldiers that he converted. So Lord Chaitanya's various, and even there was a Buddhist priest that got bopped in the head with a tray, isn't it? It's probably the most violent thing that happens in Chaitanya Leela. Anyway, so Lord Chaitanya did. He personally set this example, but the idea that one could preach to Europeans. It's interesting to know that at the time that Bhaktivinoda was organizing his mission, there were other missions in India going on. Because Europe was beginning to seduce educated Hindus in a way the Muslims had never done. As we know, the Muslims they were had a certain military superiority, but culturally they never impressed Hindu society as being in any way superior. In fact, they're in many ways they were considered barbarians because they were animal killers and so on and so forth. They didn't accept deities. They were against deity worship and so on. The British were also, of course, meat eaters, and they were against deity worship, at least in their Christianity. But England came into Europe, and this, I think, is also a key to understanding the world that Bhaktivinoda lived in and how he operated and why he did certain things. The British, or Europe, came to India at a time when Europe was everywhere ascendant. They were rising in terms, not only in military strength, but it was Europe that had invented the printing press, which was a wonder. I mean, if you had only known handwritten books, for one, if you'd only known, and in South India, for example, they would write books on palm leaf, which you can still see, and in North India on birch bark, which is sort of white, the bark of birch. And it took a long time, so books were only for rich people. It takes a long time to write out a book, and it's very expensive to pay someone to do that. And so no one but a rich person could have a library. No one but a rich... And so therefore, you see, back in the times before the printing press, people were highly dependent on priests, whether the Brahmins, the caste Brahmins in India, or the Christian priests in Europe, because it was the priests were the learned class, like the Brahmins, and no one else... Most people didn't read and write, and hardly anyone could afford to have a library. It was something for kings or priests. And so there was this, and therefore people did not have access. If you think of Lord Chaitanya's mission of coming and opening up spirituality and saying everybody has access to love of Godhead, everyone can participate, why was it so closed? Well, that was one of the reasons. So the fact that Europe had come up with this printing press, that there was widespread literacy in Europe, that average people could own libraries, and then there were railroads, you could travel. I mean, these things were, to put it in sort of slang, really blew people's minds. Now it's like a train. That's quaint. There's a train going by. It's like quaint for us. But if you're used to walking or going in an ox cart, which is not the fastest thing in the galaxy, you know, an ox cart, seeing a train go by, this huge thing, if you think of how much a train weighs and it's made out of iron and how fast it goes, it's a force that just the power of it is something no one had ever seen since the days of ancient Vedic science. No one had ever seen anything like that. It was absolutely overwhelming. There were European universities. That it wasn't just some brahmachari sitting at their guru's feet in a little straw hut. It was this magnificent architecture. And I mean, India is a place, even if you read the ancient Upanishads, India is a place that, because it was a very intelligent place, there were always many intelligent people in India in ancient times. You see in the Upanishads that there were these great debates, these great debates among scholars. And they would say things like, "If answer this question," which is like a riddle. "If you can't answer my question, your head will explode into 100 pieces, or I'll drown you in the ocean." I mean, they were very fired up in these debates. And so India is, that's a whole other topic, but India has one of the, I mean, even from the material point of view, one of the supreme intellectual histories of the world. And so when these powerful European scholars came, they may have been meat eaters and a little clueless in terms of Vedic culture, but they were, in terms of the kind of things which always impressed Indians, logic and argumentation. I mean, look at the case of Kashmiri Pandit. India was a culture, even during the time of Lord Chaitanya, where if you were really good at debate, you could travel around the world almost on the level of a modern all-star basketball player. I mean, almost that high culturally. Anyway, it's a little statement about America. But it was a place where someone who was really a great debater would travel around the world, like a country, like a conquering hero. And so the Europeans came with all this extremely sophisticated university system. And that was very impressive. And I mean, you know, symphony orchestras. If you've never heard these things before, if you're used to some guy in a village, you know, maybe playing a tambora or a sitar, and suddenly there's, you know, this massive symphony orchestra with this triumphant music. It was... So what actually happened is that Indian intellectuals were being seduced by Western culture. And even Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that he really was getting it, that he was embarrassed about Indian culture, Vedic culture. He writes a book about that, isn't it? What is it, the Bhagavad? It's some book, the famous book Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, where he says, when I was a young intellectual, I mean, think of young people nowadays. You know, they're into great athletes and speed, you know, the latest supersonic jets. If you think of what young boys put on the walls of their rooms and things like that. So here come the British with all this power and technology and sophistication and novels and great music and universities. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur claims, you know, in his humility anyway, at least telling this story, then I was carried away by it. And I became ashamed, embarrassed about my culture. Because Vedic culture, if you look at it, was very much, for one thing, an agrarian culture. The Varnashram system, that's another topic, but the Varna system is very much based on a land-based economy. That's a whole other topic. But the scriptures all describe an agrarian society, where Prabhupada says, you know, the wealth is the land and the cows. And so typically, when very sophisticated urban culture moves in, people that live on the land feel somewhat embarrassed because they're kind of, you know, sort of simple, decent people. So all these things were going on. And there were these other movements in India at the time, like the Arya Samaj, Rama Samaj, who were trying to circle the wagons and stop this onslaught of European culture, which was stealing away and seducing many of the, you know, best and brightest young Hindus. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in the face of this, he didn't simply oppose Western culture, which is interesting. He didn't simply oppose it. He admits that at one time he was enamored of it, or he tells that story. He was infatuated with Western culture, embarrassed about Vedic culture, but then he discovered the Bhagavatam. Then he discovered the Bhagavatam, and he realized that in the ancient Vedic culture, there was the highest knowledge, the most beautiful literature, the greatest culture. So how did he respond? I mean, if you think about it, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is very much a dialectical figure. If you think with the simple dialect, there's a thesis, then the antithesis, and then the synthesis. You know, I mean, it's, in other words, it's just like something is going this. I mean, let's say something is going this way, and it hits something else that's going the opposite direction. And they kind of end up going a third direction, which is a combination of the two forces. Sin, by the way, and synthesis is from the Sanskrit sung, like sankirtan. Anyway, little linguistic note. The together thesis. So Bhakti, you know, the first stage is, well, he grows up, he's enamored by Western culture. He talks about this a lot. And he's very successful at it. He's a brilliant young man. He becomes highly placed in the English administration. He has nothing but success ahead of him. He's earning money. He has a beautiful family. And he's embarrassed about Vedic culture. Then he discovers the Bhagavatam. He discovers the Bhagavatam and has something like the way he describes, he's a pure devotee from the spiritual world, but just taking his own version of it, it's something like the overwhelming experience most of us had when we discovered Krishna consciousness. I mean, many of us were embarrassed or thought little of things like organized religion. Like, a lot of us were not like beating down the doors of our local churches or synagogues. You know, can I be a monk? Can I be a priest? Sort of beating down other doors. We won't go into that. So, and we had this overwhelming experience of discovering the absolute truth. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, obviously, he's a pure devotee. He's not exactly like us. But he describes, in his own words, this overwhelming experience of discovering the truth of Krishna and Krishna consciousness and Vedic culture. So the thesis, the antithesis. And so then what happens? After this overwhelming experience, then what happens? What happens is he doesn't remain in that mode of, oh my God, I was so wrong, European culture drools, Vedic culture rules. I mean, he didn't just get into that mode. to use some of my old language. He didn't, that's not what happened. What happened is he became inspired that, okay, now what we need to do is to take this supreme Vedic culture, specifically Bhagavad Dharma, and we need to make it interesting and appealing and reasonable to the West, not simply because, and this is, I think, a very key point, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's inspiration, which was very much taken up by his son and through him by Prabhupada, Bhaktivinoda Thakur did not see the British in India simply as some people living in India. Because numerically, there was a very small number of British people in India. I mean, there weren't that many of them. And so was it that, okay, let's preach in India, and there's some British in India, so let's preach to them too. That wasn't the idea. And it also wasn't simply, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur also, and I think this is very important to understand, if we want to be serious about our history, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur did not think that all this modern stuff is going to go away. So just tolerate it, and let's just go back to the old way. I mean, obviously, he's bringing the eternal Vedic culture. He's not changing anything of the essence, but he's, you know, into doing things in the modern way, organizing, and his son, you know, buys a printing press, etc., etc. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur commits himself to modern culture, not in the sense of adopting its materialism and its materialism, but he commits himself, or he decides that this is the way the world is going. It's not going to go back. The world is not going to give up the railroad. It's not going to give up the printing presses. It's not going to give up the modern system of education. These things are not going away. Because if he thought they were, if Bhaktivinoda Thakur thought these things are going away, this is just an anomaly, a historical aberration, it's like an infection in the body which will be cured eventually in the world, India will again be the way it was before the Europeans came, before the Industrial Revolution, he didn't think that. Because if he did think that, he would say, let's just stick to our guns, let's hold the line, stick to the old way of doing things in every sense. I'm talking about the external way of doing things, not the spiritual part. Let's stick to the old way of doing things. The British will be gone someday. And let's just, you know, which is, by the way, what some Indian movements were preaching. There were Indian movements at the time that said, this is all Maya, this is all from the Malechas, because there was a very deep-rooted type of xenophobia, which would be the technical word in India, which was this fear and distrust and hostility towards foreigners. We should remember that before Hitler, racism was entirely respectable on this planet. Racism before Hitler was something like nationalism is today. It's just like if someone says, I'm from India and I'm really for India. And if someone says, I'm an American, I fly the American flag, no one's going to think that's immoral. That's what racism was like. Be true to your country, be true to your race. And the Indians were deeply absorbed in this, like the Americans were. I mean, think of America in the 1850s and 60s, the Civil War. India was completely, the Hindu society was totally immersed in this unquestioned conviction that they were a master race. That the Europeans were in many ways, you know, like this, were polluted, even racially polluted. And so there were Indian movements that were preaching, like, stay away from the European stuff, don't touch the printing press, don't take the train, let's go back to Vedic culture, let's go back to our own pristine tradition. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur committed himself to the modern world in terms of external means. This is not going away, this is the way it's going to be. And Bhaktisiddhanta upped the stakes. He went even further. It's Bhaktisiddhanta, who's sort of like the father of, you could say, the modern movement as we know it, where you have ashrams and temples and you send out preaching parties. And then Prabhupada just totally globalized Lord Chaitanya's movement and brought it right up to speed in terms of the modern world. And so it begins with Bhaktivinoda Thakur as the father of the modern Hare Krishna movement, committing Lord Chaitanya's movement to the modern world, that we are going to minister to the modern world. It's not going to go away, so let's meet them, on their own terms, let's speak their language, and let's change the world. And that inspiration, which was very much Prabhupada's mood, comes from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So any questions on these points? Yes. This is great. Talk show format. Pass the microphone around.
Society?
What?
It's for the internet.
Oh, I thought maybe a fight was going to break out like a talk show. Go ahead.
A Vedic is more like a historical Vedic society, or that something else will come from this and move in the direction that Srila Prabhupada started it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, first I'll make this point. If we read the Bhagavatam, and just even look at India. If we read the Bhagavatam, looking at it from the point of view of the history of culture, what kind of culture was it, very specifically? We find that there was a certain flexibility in Vedic culture. I'll give one example of historical flexibility from the Bhagavatam, Prithu Maharaj. It's explicitly stated in the Bhagavatam that it is Prithu who introduced into the world urban planning. And so what that means is that, I mean, when cities are small, like little towns, little like sort of, you know, there's a bunch of farms in the middle of all the farms, you have a trading center, everyone brings their produce or their whatever they've got, and they trade it, and that's how towns sort of grew up, it's trading centers. And so when cities grow to a certain size, they need to be organized. For example, Rome. Rome was kind of like this mess, ancient Rome, because it was just a little village and it grew and grew and grew. It never really had planning. So at a certain point, it was this large, sprawling imperial city, but it was a total mess. You know, the streets were all crookedness and narrow because it would be. And so at a certain point, they kind of, apparently they say that Nero actually intentionally had it burned down so he could rebuild and plan it. So the fact that the Bhagavatam says, that Prithu introduced urban planning, which it does, it explicitly says that, means that there was a historical process of urbanization going on in Bhartvarsha. Not only now, that I mean, say in the last 100 years, that Indian cities have grown tremendously, but even who knows how many thousands of years ago when Prithu was there, in other words, it wasn't just always frozen in time, like there was some eternal frozen Vedic culture. Rather, cities grew at certain times. At certain times, cities probably shrank. And there's always historical processes. I'll give you another example of flexibility. Prabhupada came to this country and sized up the situation very quickly and thought, this is not the land of, you know, sequestered male monks where you can get all the men in this country and put them away on top of a mountain like in medieval Italy or something, and they're just going to be, you know, chant Hare Krishna. I mean, at least you're not going to get straight people to do that. So Prabhupada immediately recognized this. And therefore he created, very consciously, he did it consciously because he knew he was being controversial. He knew he was doing something that was going to shock a lot of the folks back home. Prabhupada created communities like this one, where brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts and nieces and nephews all live together as a family, as an extended spiritual family, and all work together. And therefore, of course, because the girls were right there in the spiritual community, they became brahmacharinis. Now, some people who are not extremely bright accuse Prabhupada of having concocted something, that this isn't Vedic culture to have, you know, Brahma. What is this brahmacharini and the men and young boys and girls living together like this in houses? And it was, among certain people in India, scandalous. So much so that Prabhupada talks about it in his purports. He talks about the criticism he's receiving among certain people. Now, the point is that what Prabhupada did is completely Vedic. In fact, we find the word brahmacharini in America. We find this word in the Shastras. For example, it said that the sister of no less a sage than Brihaspati, who's the priest of the gods, that's like as high as it gets in this universe in terms of being a Brahmin, Brihaspati's own sister was a brahmacharini. It's right there in the Shastra. So that's an example of Prabhupada doing something which is completely Vedic, but not Hindu, necessarily. And it shows how Prabhupada didn't concoct anything. That's the great obvious defect of people that say, for example, that Prabhupada is posthumously initiating people, which is... you don't know whether to laugh or cry at that. But anyway, and they actually claim that Prabhupada could create new systems that aren't Vedic. Prabhupada doesn't have to follow Vedic culture, because there is no such thing in Vedic culture. That does not exist in Vedic culture. But Prabhupada didn't. He operated within Vedic culture because there's a certain flexibility built into Vedic culture. Flexibility doesn't mean you can do anything. There are boundaries. There are very clear, explicit boundaries. And Prabhupada himself set the boundaries for us. We cannot go outside the boundaries that Prabhupada gave us. It's just like when Lakshman drew a boundary for Sita. He said, within these boundaries, you'll be safe. And when Sita went outside, of course, there was trouble. And so you can think of Prabhupada doing what Lakshman did. Prabhupada drew a boundary for us by giving us certain basic principles and said, within this boundary, you'll be safe. You cannot be spiritually harmed if you stay within this boundary. And we've seen that people that go outside this boundary have troubles. So within those boundaries, there's certain flexibility. And Prabhupada himself exercised that flexibility. And of course, to some extent, we do also. For example, there's a museum here, the fake museum. There's no explicit mention in the Bhagavatam of an electronic museum. Like, how do you say that in Sanskrit? But the point is that it's Krishna conscious. It's Krishna conscious. And so, as far as what the world's going to look like, I would say if we stay within Prabhupada's boundaries and we adapt within those boundaries, we adjust to the time we live in, follow Bhaktivinoda Thakur's example, communicate effectively with people, explain our teachings in a way that makes sense to them and appeals to them, and do everything in our power as he did to engage people in Krishna consciousness, like that band. What's the name of your band again? Temple Bhajan Band. That is an excellent idea. I mean, if you see how far we've come, there was a time when all we had to say to or about people practicing yoga was the Sunday feast play with the bogey yogi. And, you know, everyone like rolling in the aisles as we ridicule these idiots that perform yoga asanas. And so now we have a temple bhajan band that's actually sort of melting the hearts of this large, growing, important community of intelligent people. So, I mean, that's another example. That's another example of being flexible. So I think if we follow Prabhupada and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta, if we stay within the boundaries, we stay safe, but we're flexible within those boundaries, then history will take its own path. We don't need Chairman Mao Zedong's 5-year leap where we plan the future in all detail and it destroys the country. I mean, I've never seen a 5-year leap in ISKCON that ever worked. Periodically, there have been attempts to make these 5-year leap plans or something, and nothing ever really happens. So, but if we just follow Prabhupada and try to the best of our ability to be relevant and clear and to appeal to people, I think history will just take its own course, because ultimately history is under the control of Krishna. Which Krishna really explicitly says in the Gita. Krishna says, Mayadhyakshena prakriti suyate sachara charam sahitunanena konteya jagat parivartate. The universe is going on its course, literally, going on its course, parivartate. Because varta means to turn, and pari means around, like Greek peri, perimeter. So parivartate, the world is literally rolling on its course, just going on its course because of my supervision, adhyaksha. So history, that's what history is. It's the course of events. So Krishna really is saying directly that history is under my power, that history is under my supervision. So that's personally what I'm trying to do, is just surrender to Prabhupada, to Krishna as far as I can, and try to spread this movement intelligently and just whatever. Yes. Oh, the microphone. Yes, of course. Our next contestant is a temple president from Los Angeles, California.
Sometimes we have some, maybe not a controversy, but concern that a lot of, you know, in a joking fashion, some devotees may say they didn't join Krishna consciousness because it was an organized religion, because we had a problem with organized religion. So does that mean that if we go into Krishna consciousness and we try to get organized and try to, you might say, use modern idealisms and somehow or other inculcate them within Krishna consciousness, that that's not a good idea? Or is that a good idea? Or how far do you go? How far should you not go?
Being opposed categorically to organization is definitely the sign of, you know, hippies had one too many tabs, I think. Or it's a sign of someone that's just really, seriously doesn't get it. And it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur's genius and Bhakti that he organized. He wasn't just a sadhu. He was very much a sadhu. He would go door to door very humbly. But he organized. He created a religious institution. And Bhaktisiddhanta took it further. Prabhupada took it even much further. And so there's a simple fact about this world, and that is, it is simply not possible in this world to get significant numbers of people to cooperate efficiently without organization. That is a fact about the world. And so if we oppose organization and administration, we are opposing having significant numbers of people act efficiently together. Because there was organization, Prabhupada came to my university and gave a lecture, and I was saved. Because there was organization, it was possible to print a book, and I was able to read that book. Because someone organized a Hare Krishna temple in La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles, I could visit that temple and save my soul. If there had just been a bunch of, you know, anti-organization, so-called, you know, wannabe sadhus wandering around, I'm sure I never would have met them. So it is simply not possible to systematically propagate Lord Chaitanya's teachings without organization. It's simply not possible. And frankly, managing the Hare Krishna movement goes directly back to Lord Chaitanya, who sent certain devotees to Vrindavan, sent certain devotees to West Bengal, sent other devotees to other places. Lord Chaitanya very much was managing his mission. He sent people here, there, everywhere. And so there's always been an organized Hare Krishna movement. I mean, obviously, then you can go to the other extreme. You can always go to the other extreme. We care more about systems than people and all that. So on any road, you can go off on either side. But the road of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Chaitanya's path, and all the great acharyas, is that we should systematically propagate the Hare Krishna movement. And if you to oppose that is, first of all, to be remarkably ignorant about the way the world really is. And it's really to be to have a very mystical, incoherent idea of how the world's going to be saved.
Also, from that comes this point that I think you made an interesting point about the mentality of Hindus and as being the, you know, the premier race. And sometimes it appears that devotees may also develop that kind of idealistic mentality that you know, we have the answers to everything, and these karmis, malechas, meteors, they don't know anything anyway. That they're just a bunch of...
Right on.
Whatever they are. And, you know, even though I just, you know, I've got like an eighth grade education, or I've got a high school education, and, you know, I know more than somebody this or that. Now, I understand the principle that you don't really need material qualification to be a devotee, and I know that it's devotion what really matters. But my point is that how do we get this understanding that really if, to be open-minded and to accept certain things or principles of the material world and have the ability, because when you say these things, even like maybe anybody in a temple may think that they have the answer to how it should be done. So who has that power? In other words, who can stand up and step forward and say, well, I know how to spread Krishna consciousness? You know, besides Srila Prabhupada, I'm speaking about now. And who has that strength or that understanding of how they're going to, you know, push this movement into the future of the year 2010 and 20 and 30? You know my point?
Yes,
you know, because sometimes we think that we have the answer. We could have a PhD and we could think, well, this is the way this movement should go. Or you could be just the eighth grade education devotee and say, well, I know, you know, how it should be. And so how do you make that distinction?
Okay. It's like, this is Vedic Jeopardy. Okay, first of all, Prabhupada claimed that he was giving us a spiritual science. And it's the nature of any science that if someone claims something, they can be required to demonstrate the truth of their claim. Prabhupada himself shows us this principle in the purport of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where he says that there are certain foolish people who criticize me for this or that or whatever, but these fools don't understand or don't recognize who is actually empowered to spread Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada gives as evidence of his authority as a servant of his spiritual master the practical results he's getting. And so when you connect theory to results, then you have a science. And so I would say whether a PhD or a high school dropout or someone in the middle, if anyone is claiming that I know a better way to spread Krishna consciousness or I know the real way, that would be very pretentious, I think. But if someone says, I think I have a great way to spread Krishna consciousness, they have to actually demonstrate it. And for example, here, there are many, in New Dwarka, there are many very successful programs. And which we all know that many, many, six, very, really all the basic programs, festivals, deity worship, book distribution, and restaurant, store, et cetera, et cetera. And so therefore, the devotees here have a right to say that this is an effective way to spread Krishna consciousness because of what's actually being done. And if I say that, well, there's another way. We recently, you're on the GBC conference, aren't you? You removed yourself? Was it too much? Yeah. We recently had this knockdown, drag-out discussion. And the conclusion I came to, which I think people accepted, is that when a religious or spiritual society gets to a certain size in terms of its geographic extension, this is very much an international society. It's very much a world movement. And because it's not, as Prabhupada said, like in the Shankara Sampradaya, first take sannyas, then talk about spiritual life. Because this is a devotional movement, and the whole spirit of Lord Chaitanya is to make Krishna consciousness available to everybody. And so just because of the nature of this movement, it appeals to a very wide range of people. I mean, it appeals to highly educated people, and it appeals to simple people. That's the nature of devotional movements historically. They appeal to everyone. And so this movement not only has a very, well, a complete geographic extension, it's all over the world, it also appeals to all kinds of people. So there's tremendous diversity within ISKCON. People from all different cultures of the world and from all different economic backgrounds and educational backgrounds and et cetera, et cetera. So there's like, really, you'll find the world in ISKCON, which is Prabhupada's glory. The world is in ISKCON. You can find it. And so therefore, given that situation, it is, I think, an inescapable fact. It's an irrefutable fact that there will always be diversity in ISKCON. And when we were young, and there were relatively very few devotees and few temples, and everyone, you know, there was a time when like 90% of the members of ISKCON were college dropouts from North America. And so, I mean, there was a certain understanding. It was like a community. But a society, by definition, I mean, ISKCON is a very diverse site. There will always be a range of approaches. But again, it has to be within the boundaries that Prabhupada drew. And that's why I'm quite convinced that Prabhupada properly understood is not, he didn't say, you know, this is, like when I first joined the movement, I was taught the first day that there's one and only one bona fide way to cut an apple. And to sweep a floor or to do anything. And so there's this tendency, you know, we were kind of trained that way in the early days for various reasons that, you know, this is the only bona fide way to cut an apple. In fact, I was told I'd offended the deity because I'd cut the apple slightly differently. And well, you know what I'm talking about. So I think if we look at Prabhupada and Prabhupada's different positions on the same subject, I think it's obvious that what Prabhupada did was he came and drew a boundary. And he said, within this, because it's like you've got to give people space to breathe. He knew that there are all different kinds of people. Prabhupada was a genius at engaging all different kinds of people. He gave us a boundary. So within that boundary, I think we have to think in terms of an area defined by Prabhupada, limited by Prabhupada. But within that area, you are bona fide. You are a bona fide follower of Prabhupada in good standing. And that diversity is never going to go away. And it actually is what makes ISKCON so powerful, because we can appeal to different kinds of people. And everyone can find their place in the sun within ISKCON. And so any attempt to say, like, everyone has to go to college, no one can go to college, or everyone has to preach this way, or everyone has to preach that way, I think that itself is a misunderstanding of what Prabhupada was doing. I think Prabhupada was giving us a space, an area within which everyone could find their place in ISKCON, a room, a house in which everyone can live. And that's the competition. I know in 75. I became GBC of Latin America in 74. And so in the December marathon, book distribution marathon of 75, which was about, I guess, 1 2/3 years after I'd gone to Latin America, my zone, did what had never been done before, and that is they defeated Radha Damodar in a marathon. And so that was in December. Then in January, Tamal Krishna Goswami and myself we both were in L.A. with Prabhupada, and we were on a walk together in Santa Monica Park. And Prabhupada was like, he was really into it. He we were walking, and he was basically, in his own way, saying, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, are you going to take that? In his own way, he was saying that. Like, are you going to take that? You know, like, he defeated you, so what? And then he was joking, he laughed, and he put down his cane like he would do sometimes. He would plant his cane when he wanted to make a point. And everybody stopped. And then he said, I like this competition. I like this competition. And so, because it was good-spirited. It was among, you know, a family. And so I think that that's very healthy. I think that, for example, in New Dwarka, there are so many successful programs. So if someone thinks, well, I have a somewhat different way to preach. I mean, obviously, some things here are universal. I mean, some things here are so successful that, I mean, no one could say that's not the way to do it. But in certain details, some people may approach it in a different way. But then it puts the burden on them, whether it's myself or anyone else, it puts the burden on us to go out and do something practical. Because it's not scientific for me to say that, oh, I know a better way to do it. I'm not going to do it because I don't have to, because it's just obvious that it's better. I mean, that's not scientific. That's not scientific. And so therefore, I think that the fact that there's diversity allows all of us to find our happy place in ISKCON. It allows all of us to be very comfortable in our relationship with Prabhupada, enlivened. He allows all of us to follow our own inspiration, yet within those boundaries. And the competition, this sort of good-spirited, good-hearted competition, where I see that you've done very nice service. Now, if I think I have a better way to do certain things, I've got to prove it. And therefore, the diversity is not a cause of fighting, but it's a cause of forcing all of us to go out and really produce for Prabhupada. So that's why I said. Yes. Yes.
And here we are 30-something years later, and we're still debating this point.
I would say that it makes perfect sense within a particular community to have a standard. I think that makes perfect sense, that in a particular community, this is the way we do it. However, Prabhupada explicitly says in his purport to 4854 that there's no hard and fast rules. There's no stereotype method of deity worship. And so ISKCON, deeply understanding that point, wrote a book to make everything. Anyway, so to stereotype everything. But the point is, but even in that deity worship book, it says there's like, you know, like the high, middle, and low standard depending on your circumstances. And so what we find even during Lord Chaitanya's time is that particular temples would have their traditions. And there's a certain power in tradition. I mean, knowing, for example, let's say I'm going to do some deity worship in New Dwarka, and I know that for so many generations in the future, let's say it'll be said, well, for centuries it's been done this way. I mean, there's something wonderful about that. Like at Oxford University, say in England, they have certain traditions which have been going on for almost 1,000 years. Like certain ways of, let's say, dressing at certain ceremonies or certain things you say. And so there's a certain power. What tradition does is it ties together the past and the present. It sort of like is this bridge that goes throughout time and links everybody together so that you really feel you're right there with people that lived 1,000 years ago or hundreds of years ago. And it gives a certain identity to a particular community. It creates a certain, and also it creates stability, because if you know that this has always been the standard, you won't dare to change it. And so it creates a certain stability. So I mean, obviously, it doesn't mean a community can never adjust anything. It doesn't mean everything has to be an eternal tradition once it's ever been done, because that would be the other extreme. Like, once anything has ever been done, it can never be changed. So there's some adjustment, but there's nothing wrong, I think. There's some value in having local traditions. But I think they should be understood as such. That's what they are. They're local traditions. I mean, clearly, bowing down to Krishna is not a local tradition. That's always been going on. So again, there has to be this balance.
It seems that a lot of the debate that goes on at ISKCON isn't so much about the diversity within the boundaries, but the debate about what the boundaries are. The diversity is about what the boundaries
right.
are.
Right. However, I think that for some people, some devotees, it's sort of a new idea that there is a boundary. There's a range of acceptable ways of doing things. Because just like what Savas was saying, there's this tendency that's sort of like this hard line thing, like this is the only way, this is the only way. And it carries over not only the ISKCON to say is the only way, but, I mean, ISKCON is the greatest. I think that's very clear. But to say this is the only possible way, even within ISKCON, that this is the way I understand Prabhupada. I'll give you an example. Rabindra Sroop tells a story. When he joined the Hare Krishna movement in Philadelphia back in the early 70s, he was in a doctoral program at Temple University. He was getting a PhD in religion. And so naturally he wondered what I wondered when I joined. Should I drop out of school? Should I stay in school? And so like I did, he wrote a letter to Prabhupada to ask him. So Prabhupada wrote back and said, this is very nice, you should finish your degree. So literally, I mean, this is a literal, when the devotees and the leaders of the temple read that letter from Prabhupada, they told him, Prabhupada obviously wants you to drop out. I mean, it was right there, you got a letter. And he said, Prabhupada knows that you're attached, and so he's just trying to encourage you, but his real desire is that you drop out. And so here you have these leaders of the temple urging this new devotee to do exactly the opposite of what Prabhupada just ordered him to do. I had the same experience. So My point is that if we accept that there is a range of that Prabhupada gave us an area in which we could serve him, just that admission alone will lead us to think differently about these things. And I think we would disagree much less about the boundaries if we first accepted that there is a permanent diversity of ISKCON that's a strength, not a weakness, as long as we follow Prabhupada. It's just like, for example, when they retrofit buildings to make them resistant to earthquakes. What they do is they build in flexibility. Like, for example, they have some these luxury apartment buildings, say, in the Wilshire Corridor, where they actually put this entire building on rollers, really, so that when these seismic waves come, the building just sort of, it doesn't, it's like judo. You know, it's like judo. If you just, like, confront the person head on, you can really be knocked down. But there's a way of kind of stepping a little bit to the side, and then, so flexibility, and in the same way, if we have a little flexibility in ISKCON where we can sort of, we can adjust, we can adapt to changing historical times, but the building doesn't, it's not like a building on Wilshire Boulevard after the earthquake ends up in Long Beach or something. You know, it's still in the same place, but it's an area within which the building can move a little bit. So perhaps we'll stop here before I push my luck. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Didn't even give me the sign.